Trump is the worst president the United States ever had. But if you don't have enough reason to get rid of him on all these other things, including the fact that my grandchildren, 9 of them, will not have clean air to breathe or clean water to drink when they're my age, if you can't get rid of this guy without a phony setup here, like Russiagate, then, you know, there's no hope for you.
Notes from the Left Forum 2018. The conference presented critical analysis of the day's issues in an effort to formulate new strategies to counter the rising tide of the reactionary right all over the Western world. In this program, speakers from a panel named Russiagate and WikiLeaks, presented at the Left Forum by political activist, broadcaster, and comedian Randy Credico. First, we hear peace activist and ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern, and then award-winning journalist Max Blumenthal, who breaks down the historical context for Russiagate. But first, ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Contrary to what you hear in the mainstream media, he shares discrepancies and falsehoods promulgated through the press by the CIA, the NSA, and others, and their zeal to cover their tracks. Ray McGovern.
So what I'd like to do is go back to the notion of Russiagate, which starts with Vladimir Putin, right? He's sitting around and he's watching the campaign 2016, and he's got his associates around. He says, "Wow, this Trump guy! Wow, he's unpredictable," and he brags about being unpredictable, and he lashes out at the slightest offense or slight. Oh, man, this is going to be really fun. This is just the guy I want to cross the ocean with his fingers on the nuclear codes. So do everything you can, please. Help him win, because this is going to be really fun. Give me a break. That's the major premise, guys. That's the major premise. That makes no sense. I've been watching Soviet and Russian leaders for 55 years, ever since I left this wonderful, beautiful town, okay? And what they expect, what they want, what they dearly hope for is predictability. Even Hillary was more predictable. Not that she wouldn't have been any better. But so the whole premise falls if you look at it closely. The other thing, of course, is that Hillary was a shoo-in. She was going to win. Almost everybody thought she was going to win. So what percentage is there in the head of Russia saying, you know, she's going to win, but, you know, let's just for fun, let's hack into the DNC and see what we can find, you know. And this is going to be good. Yeah, that'll be fun. And then she'll be even more angry with me, and we'll have to live with that. But yeah, that's going to be fun. That doesn't make any sense either. Now, we know from the two of our veteran intelligence professionals for sanity folks who were former technical directors at the National Security Agency, okay, that everything is collected. And they couldn't really say that until Ed Snowden came out and said, everything's collected, and here are the, we used to call them view graphs, here are the slides, okay? And it shows exactly how they are collected. So the business about NSA not being able to find the hack, the Russian hack. Yeah, thanks for laughing. Down in Washington, nobody laughs. They can't find it. They can't find it. Keep looking, Bob Mueller. Keep looking. Okay. They can't find it because it's not there, folks. If it were there, they would have it. NSA has everything. NSA has all Hillary's emails, even the ones that she chopped up and tried to destroy. They have everything. So that's one major thing. And the other consideration to remember in all this and explains why the deep state felt that they could play fast and loose with the law and the Constitution is because Hillary was gonna win. All right. Now nothing is explainable unless you accept that they felt, no, look, we can do insurance policies, we can take real liberties with what the Department of Justice or what the FBI usually does, and you know Hillary's gonna win, so instead of being put in jail. We're going to get a special commendation award. That's what they thought. Now, Obama was a tool of John Brennan. John Brennan was head of the CIA for Obama's second term, and he was his national security advisor for counterterrorism during the first term. There's lots of evidence to that. I won't go into it. Maybe just to say that when the torture report was completed by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Obama tried everything he could, every trick in the trade, to prevent it from being published until the new chairman came in, Richard Burr from North Carolina, who the first thing he did, anybody remember? First thing he did was, now I'm the chair of this committee now, and I recall all the copies of that torture report, all 7,000 pages, and I want them back now, and I want them back now. Okay, now there are, I think, five editions out there. And Gina Haspel, I have in my mind's eye, she was right at the Senate committee, giving her copy right back. So there's supposed to be a copy extant in the Obama files. If they say, Obama, you had a deep six stat, he will. So that's a biggie. Obama was a tool of the deep state. He was scared of it. Now, Obama himself was careful because he's a lawyer, right? So on the 18th of January, when he was just about to leave, 2 days away, he made a statement which says, you know, I have to tell you, this is a press briefing. The Russian hack, he didn't go like this, the Russian hack, we don't know how it got to WikiLeaks. The conclusions of the intelligence community on that are inconclusive. His words. Oh, now isn't that neat? On June 12th, 2016, Julian Assange announced, I have emails relating to Hillary Clinton and they're just about to be published. Whoa, June 12th. June 14th, CrowdStrike, a very dubious entity doing technical work for the DNC and Hillary, has said, we have found corruption. And there are signs that there are Russian intrusions here. That's the 14th. On the 15th, Guccifer II arises out of the ashes and says, yeah, we did it, and we're working for WikiLeaks. Now give me a break. That was never proven. And the metadata that we got on another leak that was highly advertised as a Russian leak just doesn't pan out. There's no evidence to that at all. So we're going to dismiss that. But what I'd like to move to, the major event here, is March of 2017. On March 7th, Julian Assange made an announcement. And he said a CIA source, we think it was a contractor that had a conscience, okay, was looking at the cyber offensive tools developed by CIA with the help of NSA and was aghast. And he gave us a treasure trove of information that rivals what Ed Snowden brought out into Hong Kong in how big it is and how important it is. Whoa, that's big, all right? So what happened? Well, the Times did notice on March 7th that one of these tools allows somebody to take control of your car, your computerized car, and make it go 100 miles an hour, okay, and kill you, okay? Oh, that was neat. Did that ever happen? Anybody? Well, when did it happen? Hastings. You know, you don't have to be conspiracy theorists to see how these tools work, right? Now, by the way, conspiracy theorists, that's what Alan Dulles used. When people said, wait a second, we think the CIA may have been involved in JFK's assassination, he said, conspiracy theorists, conspiracy theorists, conspiracy theorists. And he succeeded in branding everyone. And we all know now, at least I know, to my satisfaction, that the CIA was deeply involved in that assassination. So conspiracy theorists has been around since then. Do not blanch before it. So what happened? Well, on the 7th, the Times did hold a little story. And then there was another story. I talked about a South Korean?
Samsung.
Yeah, Samsung. Behind the times here. TV. And what did that TV do? When it ostensibly was off, it allowed, it recorded every conversation that went on in your bedroom or wherever it was placed, okay? Now, this is the big one. On March 31st, of 2017, I get a call 7:15 in the morning.
Hello, Mr. McGovern, this is RT. Can you come in?
I said, come in? You never call me this early. You call me around noon. What? You're not even open yet. You gotta come in. We got Eurovision. What's going on? We'll send you the link. So I send the link. It's Vault 7, Part 3, called Marble Framework. Now, what does that do? That allows the cyber tool in CIA's possession to intrude into a computer system or a server, disguise, the word is used, is obfuscate. Some of my old friends there in CIA know these big words. Obfuscate who hacked in, and then leave telltale signs like, oh, well, it showed that they worked in five languages, Persian, Arabic, Chinese, Korean, and Russian, Cyrillic. So, wow, that was interesting, right? So I looked at that, I said, that is interesting, and I had to get in there by 9 o'clock. So here I am driving in the carpool lane, you know, all alone, for the cause, right? And I said, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? So you call Bill Binney, right? And he tells you what to say. No, it's very easy. That's the beauty of having this veteran intelligence professionals of standing. You've got specialists that won't quit in very, very different areas. And, of course, Bill is the guy in NSA. So he says, Ray, this is what you say. I was there when they started developing this. It's developed by NSA. They're the specialists. But they gave it to CIA to do the dirty work, okay? Now, tell them this, Ray. Vault 7 involves 700 million lines of code. So McGovern says, that sounds like a lot, Bill. Hey, Ray. He says, each line of code costs $25. Can you do a multiplication, Ray? Yeah, I can do that math. So we're talking billions of dollars, right? Now, Marble framework was, Bill says, at least 100 or 200 million of those codes. And what did it do? Well, I explained what it did. When that hit the fan, I have to tell you that the Washington Post reporter, Ellen Nakashima, she didn't get the memo. And so she, to her credit, reported on it right away. She said, headline, Washington Post the next day, WikiLeaks' latest release of CIA cyber tools could blow the cover on agency hacking operations. Whoa. She pointed out that the obfuscation tool could be used to conduct forensic attribution double game or false flag operations, okay? Now, why do you suppose this didn't appear in the New York Times or after Ellen Nakashima got the memo in the Washington Post? Why do you suppose it appear anyway? Well, it's very clear. The mainstream media goes to CIA and says, should we report this? And they say, no, don't report this. You know, people aren't real smart, but they might say, oh, there was a hack in the DNC. Oh, and there were telltale signs in Cyrillic. Oh, yeah, like the name of the first head of the KGB, Felix Simunovich Dzerzhinsky. Wow. They might say, oh, I wonder, could it be possible that these cyber tools in the arsenal of CIA were really responsible for this? Where does this leave us? Well, it leaves us with an explanation as to why James Comey thought, well, he better not send his specialists in to look at the DNC computers, because, my God, what would they find? What might they find? They might find a Marble framework, huh? So it explains a lot of things, and it's very disconcerting to think that Comey was in on this whole thing. He knew about it. He knew if he sent his experts there to look at the DNC computers, they would have come back and say, Mr. Comey, my God, you won't believe what we found in there. We can't figure it out. Should we go to NSA to task? No. Don't go to NSA. So that's as phony as it is. And it's a pretty sad story. And people like me who have this old-fashioned view from our intelligence analysis experience that it's really good to find out what the truth is, okay, no matter what it is, you know. Well, people say, well, you must be favoring Trump. And I say, my God, you know, Trump is the worst president the United States ever had. But if you don't have enough reason to get rid of him on all these other things, including the fact that my grandchildren, 9 of them, will not have clean air to breathe or clean water to drink when they're my age. If you can't get rid of this guy without a phony setup here, like Russiagate, then, you know, there's no hope for you.
Ex-CIA peace activist Ray McGovern, and you're listening to Notes from the Left Forum 2018 from a panel put together by Randy Credico called Russiagate and WikiLeaks. Here on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, this is WBAI New York. Next up is award-winning journalist, senior editor with the Gray Zone Project, contributor to Truthdig and The Real News, Max Blumenthal. He's the author of best-selling Republican Gomorrah Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party and soon to be published by Verso, The Management of Savagery. Blumenthal says he never would have seen himself taking on a panel about anything Russia-related 2 years ago or so, but the situation has been forced upon those who don't want a new Cold War and possibly a new hot war. Max Blumenthal.
I was at my friend Yasha Levine's place. He's done a lot of great writing for the exile from inside Russia during the one of the most pivotal periods leading up to Russiagate, and is now here. And he had a book on his coffee table, Privatizing Russia, by Schlafer and various other economists. This isn't a book about privatizing Russia from a critical point of view. It's how they did it. It was basically their blueprint. Schlafer came out of Harvard, who was installed by Larry Summers, who was one of Clinton's top economists, to basically loot Russia's economy. They were actually enriching companies that many of them had a stake in. And, you know, it led to people bartering their goods on the streets, just this feeling of complete chaos, and that this great nation that had once existed was being weakened from the outside and absolutely destroyed. It was like a Mad Max atmosphere. The poor and the old, who are depending on their pensions under the Soviet Union and on public benefits, some of them just literally died. There were 3 to 5 million excess deaths. That means almost 5 million people just dropped off the face of the earth. Poverty reached such a point that 90 million people were in poverty. That's up from 3 million people under the Soviet Union. Then we went in when Yeltsin, our guy, was running in 1996 against a communist candidate. And we sent Pete Wilson's consultants, you know, this moderate Republican from California, we sent Pete Wilson's consultants to steal the election. You can see Spinning Boris is a pretty good comedy that's actually pretty subversive by today's standards. You should all watch that great film with Jeff Goldblum and see how we stole the 96 election to keep this project going. All along, we were expanding NATO. You know, George Washington University's National Security Archive has finally produced proof of what everybody already knew, which is that the George H.W. Bush administration lied to Gorbachev and his national security team and diplomatic team and promised that they would not expand NATO beyond Germany. And then we proceeded to do so and put advanced missile systems on Russia's borders, something the United States would never have allowed to take place on its own borders, which leads to this siege mentality, drives the siege mentality. Yeltsin basically becomes too drunk to continue on. He appoints Vladimir Putin, who had been involved in he was actually involved in the privatization project in St. Petersburg, and he was close to the Anatoly Chubais and the kind of guys who had been around Gorbachev and moved into Yeltsin's administration as the partners of the Harvard boys. And everyone thought, oh, Putin's going to be great. He's going to keep this thing going. And if you go back to 2000, 2001, you can find a lot of people, including Bill Browder, praising Putin. What he proceeds to do is start throwing the oligarchs in prison, the oligarchs who wouldn't pay into Russia's economy, from Yukos oil and so on. And this sent shockwaves through the national security state in the U.S. and through the foreign policy establishment in Washington. You know, Putin was no socialist. He was basically re-centering the economy around a kind of state capitalist model. We responded with color revolutions in Georgia, removing Edward Shevardnadze first, then moving on to Ukraine with the Orange Revolution. These were revolutions that may have been guided by the CIA, but were carried out through foundations like the Open Society Institute, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is mostly U.S. funded. And, you know, we created private media to drive these revolutions. And, you know, many of the students who participated in them were earnest, good-hearted people who thought, you know, we just want freedom. We just want what the West has to offer. But they were ultimately used as pawns in a geopolitical game that continued this process of destabilization. At the Munich Security Conference in 2007, Putin stands up with John McCain sitting next to Joe Lieberman in the front row. I think it was Lieberman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Joe Mentum, remember that? And he was his only endorsement for president was from the New Republic under Marty Peretz. He's really inspiring. You should, and you know, go back and look at that video and look at the look on John McCain's face when Putin speaks and he says, "We will now act in Russia's national security and national interests, and we will not tolerate expansion on our borders any further." And he basically puts his foot down, and that was, I think, when this process of the new Cold War really started to intensify. The next year, Georgia invades South Ossetia, which was Russian territory. We're constantly told Russia invaded. No, it was a Georgian invasion by Mikhail Saakashvili, who himself was a CIA National Endowment for Democracy project, who was egged on by the U.S. He wound up eating his tie on national television, literally, and got stomped. Another event that sent shockwaves through the national security state in the U.S. Putin steps aside to Medvedev. After 2008, Medvedev comes in and basically was not particularly popular in Russia. The Libya events really showed how Medvedev's presence actually frightened Russia's military intelligence apparatus, because what Russia did at the UN when there was this critical vote on whether to allow was a no-fly zone in Libya, they abstained. What's Libya now? Open air slave auctions, the destabilization of North Africa, the rise of Boko Haram, the arms flow out to the south and they flow out to Libya, to Syria. Complete chaos. Putin steps back in, says we got to restabilize. He steps back in after the Magnitsky sanctions come in. Magnitsky sanctions were the product of Bill Browder, someone who's widely hailed as this great Russia expert today. He was at Hermitage Capital. He was one of the oligarchs. I think he's actually the grandson of Earl Browder, who was the, yeah, I'm not joking. And he had come to Russia to loot the economy. He owed something like $240 million in taxes. And, you know, the standard story, official story, is that his lawyer was beaten to death in a Russian prison, Sergei Magnitsky. If you watch Andrei Nekrasov's film, which is effectively banned in the U.S., Browder has prevented it from being shown at the European Parliament. If you watch this film, you're going to see an entirely different story. This Norwegian filmmaker who is anti-Putin started following Browder around thinking he was going to make this film about this great dissident and found out that he was an international con artist and vulture capitalist who had basically used his personal fortune to doctor American foreign policy and engineer a 99-1 vote in the U.S., or 99-0 vote in the U.S. Congress to sanction Russia unprovoked. I mean, there was no clear provocation for these sanctions. The Magnitsky sanctions, you know, deepened the sense of enmity and mistrust and the fear in Russia that the U.S. is coming back for more. And now the Magnitsky sanctions, by the way, have been expanded to the global Magnitsky sanctions. So they're now being applied against Venezuela. They will soon be used to destroy Nicaragua's economy and so on. So we have to see the repercussions of the Cold War globally. Ukraine is next. The Maidan, everyone remembers that. It was another color revolution style operation with many of the figures in the Maidan supported by the foundations, National Endowment for Democracy, Open Society Institute, along with the street muscle of Right Sector, Pravdi Sector, who are Nazis. I remember at the time the neocon Jamie Kirchick wrote about Putin's imaginary Nazis in foreign policy. Well, those imaginary Nazis just celebrated an SS battalion last month in the open. They've renamed streets after Stepan Bandera and Roman Shukevich, who were involved in the pogroms of Jews. They actually renamed the street that leads to Baba Yar, the site of Jewish extermination after Stepan Bandera. So I don't think we can imagine. I mean, they're real. Those Nazis are real. And this is the part of, you know, you have to understand the fear of Russia to have Nazis on their border. And then, of course, Syria. I don't want to spend more than 10 seconds on it, but we enacted a $1 billion program to arm and equip what we consider to be moderate rebels in the only allied state in the Arab League, the only state allied with Russia. So Nazis and jihadists coming at you on your borders or in your ally, in the middle of your allied states, marching on their capitals. The RT incident with Liz Wahl, this, as I wrote for Truth Dig, was engineered by the Foreign Policy Institute, which was a rebranding of the Project for the New American Century of Robert Kagan and William Kristol. Same board of directors, pretty much the same sources of funding. Paul Singer, vulture capitalist, pro-Israel vulture capitalist Paul Singer, backed this whole operation. Just different faces like Jamie Kirchick, who are the next generation of neocons. And they engineered Liz Wahl's resignation on air on RT to not just humiliate RT, but to cast it as this Kremlin influencing operation. And to some extent, they succeeded with the complete support of mainstream U.S. media. I'll kind of end it in the 2016 campaign because we kind of know what happened next. But, you know, a lot of these figures, I would just point out that a lot of these figures who were involved with Liz Wahl and recruiting her, and who are actually trying to recruit other, have tried to recruit other figures out of RT, just something I know about. They centered around the Free Beacon, which is a neoconservative publication in Washington, and Orion Strategies, which is a lobbying firm that represented the Saakashvili government of Georgia. And that group was the original group that funded the creation of the Steele dossier before it was passed on to Perkins Coie, the law firm, close to Hillary Clinton and its campaign and the DNC, that funded the Steele dossier, the Dodgy dossier, which was really used as the narrative basis for Russiagate. That's how the media was able to understand Trump-Russia collusion and Russia's nefarious actions to interfere and meddle in the West. The Steele dossier was dropped, and I'm just going to end it here. The Steele dossier was dropped in January 2017. It was not only funded first by the neocons, then by the Clinton campaign, but James Comey, the FBI director, was planning to pay for it until its existence was exposed in October 2016. And then it was publicly revealed after James Clapper, director of national intelligence, you know, he oversees the FBI and the CIA. He sent James Comey to brief Donald Trump on the existence of the dossier. Then he leaked to Jake Tapper. It was like a handoff from Clapper to Tapper. He leaked to Jake Tapper that Trump was being briefed on this dossier, the dossier that Comey himself had attempted to fund. And from there, it was reported in CNN. Jake Tapper and his team with Carl Bernstein, who's been telling the whole Beltway Press Corps that they're covering something worse than Watergate, just won an award at the White House Press Correspondents Association, where Randy was thrown out of. They got up on stage and won an award for the story that was basically just leaked to them by Jim Clapper. They just took dictation from the top spook and then won an award for it, which shows how the Beltway Press Corps is just patting itself on the back for this operation. Then 2 days later, BuzzFeed leaks the, or just releases the full dossier. Trump comes out before the Washington Press Corps, Jim Acosta badgering him, yeah, what about Russia? What about Russia? And Trump says, fake news, fake news. And then, you know, the whole public is talking about the P tape and all the salacious details, and Russiagate becomes this mainstream phenomenon. So you have a confluence of interests, the never Trumpers and the Clinton people, and, you know, they want to oppose Trump without talking about the economy or anything, you know, real. And then you have the neocons and the national security state, whose interests I laid out here, and now it's their world and we're living in it.
You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum 2018. The Left Forum was held in June at John Jay College in New York City. In this program, you heard a panel organized by Randy Credico on Russiagate. You heard ex-CIA analyst and peace activist Ray McGovern, followed by award-winning journalist Max Blumenthal. The program was produced at WBAI and Pacifica Radio by Richard Barr and Linda Perry, with thanks to the Left Forum. And thank you for listening.